Hey everybody, Dr. Keith here. Just arrived and top of the hour too, I see. So almost late, but not late. For those of you not been here with me before, my name's Keith Scott Mumby. I'm a British MD living in California. I wrote a book many years ago called Virtual Medicine, which had a lot to do with up-to-date science about how fields and information held in other spaces than the physical reality were actually influencing our world, and particularly in respect of medicine and healing. It was a whole new medical paradigm. So I've been interested in this phenomena ever since, with various interesting diagnostic devices. I had a machine when I was in the UK which would light up a person's acupuncture points. That was amazing. We charged the person up to 50,000 volts. They were safely earthed, but it was, it wasn't a lot of electricity, just a lot of charge, like static electricity. And put in a dielectric, typically just shove the hand in a polythene bag and turn down the lights, and we would see blue light streaming out of holes in the skin. What was amazing was that a lot of these holes seemed to fit Chinese acupuncture points. So, that kind of advanced science, if you like, and I made it my job to collect a lot of the real science. Up to that point, it was really two belief systems. Orthodox science believed all this stuff was bunk, and then alternative and holistic people all believed it was great. But there was nothing bridging the gap, and I wanted to start bridging the gap as best I could. So I wrote a book. As I said, it was called Virtual Medicine, collecting then as much of the science as I could. The thing that triggered it was learning from Jacques Benveniste that he'd sent electromagnetic signals of curare over the internet and killed five white mice at the other end when it was decoded. I rang him up to talk to him, and he wouldn't confirm this, but he did say he'd done it with caffeine. I suppose he was nervous about curare. Anyway, that was just a trigger. I thought, my goodness, there's a whole new science and medicine paradigm on the way. And indeed, I was right. It's blossomed and burgeoned to such an extent. Since then, there's probably 1,000 times the amount of science that there was back then in the 90s when I started researching this. And if you were on yesterday's teleclass with William Tiller, you'd hear me say this is how I got to meet him, basically. Because of the book, Virtual Medicine, I got invited to fly over to the States and give a keynote in Salt Lake City. Bill was on just before me and revealed some of his amazing secrets, like intention, being able to reside in equipment and influence scientific outcomes. And I remember standing on the stage and saying, Bill, you've just destroyed all of science. I mean, how is it possible to objectively test anything if the observer's ideas and preconditioned thoughts can actually reside in the equipment and influence the outcome? What's the point? Well, of course, there's a lot of truth in that. And that's something we experience, isn't it? That a lot of science and a lot of investigation basically goes the way the person believes. The orthodox people talk about what they call voodoo science, and they know it's all junk. So without even necessarily doctoring the figures, and there's plenty of that goes on, trust me, faking of figures to make a point, especially common in the pharmaceutical industry that likes to fake its results in order to make more profits. But even without sort of criminal science like that, it does seem that orthodox scientists will find a lot of these things don't work. Those who are holistically inclined find out they do work. Anyway, so I struck up friendship with Bill. We've known each other for years, and that's why he very kindly consented to become a special guest yesterday. And if you are on with us, you'll realize he let loose some dazzling science. So it's my job today to try and pick up the pieces, as it were, and try and make it more coherent and more understandable for you. The question is where to start. He threw so much at us, almost too much science, and a lot of strange scientific and technical terms like U-gauge space, symmetry. I mean, symmetry is an ordinary English word, but in science it has a special meaning. It means being uniform throughout, you know, the same in all parts. He threw these out as if he were lecturing kids on campus at the university, which of course he wasn't. I'm well aware that a lot of very spiritual seekers and deeply, you know, deep thinkers and people who are very involved in higher planes of spirituality and thought would have been on the call and not really, perhaps never been exposed to some of these scientific words. So during the talk, I did my best to keep him on track and the best to step in without seeming to interrupt all the time, to step in once in a while just to clarify some of the points he was making or some of the words that he was using. I mean, some of the words were typically used in science, even though they're not scientific. The word moiety came up quite a lot. He used that several times, I noticed. A moiety just means a small little chunk of something. It's not confined to science, but, you know, a small particle, or it could be a bunch of particles. It just means a bit of stuff, really, rather than an idea or energy. It means stuff, definitely. So if you came across that word and were confused, that's what it meant. Okay, so, as I said, where to get started is almost the difficult question for today. Let's start with something that was brought up, which was the new Copernican scale revolution. What did all that mean? You heard me say Nicholas Copernicus was a pretty amazing guy. He was a musician and a doctor and a diplomat and an astronomer, mathematician. He was born in Poland at the time, a part of what later became Prussia. And he's famous for developing a mathematical model for the solar system with the sun at its center. Now, he lived in the late 15th century, was born 1470, something like that, and lived in a time when if you said things like that, you were very likely to get burnt to death as a heretic. That's how much the Christian church hated truth. They would just burn people for telling any stories that didn't fit with their model. So he was scared to do that and asked that his work be published after he died. And that was duly done. Well, it created a huge revolution. It was the beginning of science, really, and cosmology. It was really the beginning of the whole idea that the church and religion did not hold the sort of the key and the complete rights to truth about our reality. Up to that point, everything that you knew about the world or thought you knew was what you were told by scholastic and religious documents like the Bible. And those who, there are people who passionately believe every sentence in the Bible. But if you do, then you've got to swallow the fact that the earth was only born 8,000 years ago and nothing's evolved, and that's the end of that. It all sprung up one afternoon when God had nothing else to do, so he just created a world. Most of us find that kind of childish story just so difficult to swallow. We have a different view of the world, and whatever God's place in it, that's another debate. But the way of looking at the world is to go out and measure things and see things and look under microscopes and look through telescopes to cut things up, to test things and see what's actually going on. And Copernicus was really the start of that revolution. No longer was knowledge considered something sacred that was controlled by the religious bodies. It became a life in itself. It became inquiring man. And humankind certainly did begin to inquire, as you know, and in 500 years we made tremendous progress. And in fact, it's been accelerating progress. You've probably heard the fact that there's been more change. Well, in my lifetime, I'm nearly coming up to 67. In that time, there's probably more progress being made in those 67 years, more advancements in science than were made in the entire history of evolution on Earth up to that point. And it's getting faster. The last 20 years of my life, it's been dazzlingly fast, and it's difficult to keep up with. When I was a kid, there were science fiction stories with this kind of strange but exciting idea, unbelievable idea, that we'd be able to speak to each other across a distance and see images. So you'd be you'd be talking to your friend in some other part of the universe and seeing pictures of them. Well, today, of course, we have exactly that with Skype and cell phones and things that carry live video. You can actually do that. So in one lifetime, it's gone from science fiction and fantasy to actually being a truth. Anyway, so we are talking about a second Copernicus magnitude revolution in science. What did Bill mean by that? The big switch that's happened in science in recent years is that we've now switched away from the purely physical model, you know, the stuff model. This is the Newton model, and even Einstein to an extent. It's all about mass and matter and material, and it concerns chemistry, molecules, energy that moves these physical things around. You know, that kind of model that we get taught at high school, and when you go to university, it gets a little bit more peculiar because of quantum physics and things like that. But essentially, it's a physical model that's centered around stuff, particularly particles and energy, which exists through time, makes changes through time in space. So hence the space-time model. All that's kind of been overthrown. I mean, Bill was almost uncomfortable with me saying orthodox science is out of the window, but it pretty well is. That might seem strong words. But all that old idea now is very old-fashioned, and we realize that matter doesn't rule anymore, that information is what rules. And you heard me say, my little saying, that information implies consciousness. That the word information doesn't have any meaning except there's consciousness present to know what it means. Even the famous physical equation that defines our universe, E equals mc squared, what does c squared mean? I mean, mathematically, it means the square of the speed of light. But what on earth does that mean? It's almost, it is meaningless without consciousness being able to interpret what it means. It's rather weird. It's like saying the square root of the river Mississippi. It's a purely conceptual thing that needs a consciousness to appreciate what it really means. So this consciousness and information dimension has opened up, and that seems to be what rules the universe. Information has now emerged as something that is senior to matter, energy, space, and time. Indeed, it controls matter, energy, space, and time. The information field, this is the other thing that's happened in this field, in this territory, is that fields have come to be understood to rule everything. In the old days, you know, the high school days, it was magnetic fields and gravity fields. You remember these? And a field has certain properties in physics. It stretches outwards indefinitely. It's got the same qualities in all parts. It may not have the same intensity, but you can't take out a piece of a magnetic field and find that it's different from other parts of the magnetic field. Whereas with a physical object, you can do that. If you take a motor car, you can pull out the carburetor, and it's different to the wheels and different to the manifold or exhaust. So parts are separate, and that characterizes physical things and physical stuff. But in a field, it's all the same. The magnetic field is exactly the same in quality, if not quantitatively, right to the edge of the universe. So we like this. This is a holistic idea, right? Fields are holistic. They're encompassing the allness of everything, which is a very holistic idea. So it's what we like. You can't divide it into bits, and that's where orthodox science goes wrong. You know, they're taking life apart into molecules and smaller pieces. It's like dismantling a radio. I mean, you can get transistors out of it, bits of wire, blobs of solder. You might not quite understand what all that means, but it has almost nothing to do with the function of a radio. We turn a radio on and we hear sound, which is being transmitted around the Earth. We can hear music, we can hear people's voices. And unless you use the radio in that way, you'd never gain any deeper understanding of what a radio is by taking it to pieces. You'd never spot the fact that this, when it's assembled properly in the order it should be, that if you push a few buttons and knobs, you can actually hear music coming from it. So this is the difference between what we call holism and reductionism. Reductionism in science means taking it down into tiny pieces and hoping to learn more. And the smaller you divide it, the more you understand. And we thought if you got things down to molecular size centuries ago, that would be understandable. But then it wasn't, because molecules are made of atoms. So it was sort of split into different atoms. And atoms were thought to be undividable until the early part of the 20th century. The New Zealand, what was his name, Cavendish, Bragg, wasn't it? Lawrence Bragg split the atom, the Cavendish laboratory. And then since then, we've had all these subatomic particles, and some of those are breaking up into smaller and smaller particles. You might begin to wonder whether at the end of it, there's going to be any matter or any stuff left, because we know that 99.999 and lots of 9% of all stuff just isn't there. It's empty space. So why is a teacup, why does it stay as a teacup? You know, we can pour tea in it, it doesn't leak, even though it's almost all empty space. Well, the answer turns out to be there's an information field. It's got various names. We had Rupert Sheldrake 2 or 3 weeks ago talking about the morphic field. And a morphic field means a field giving shape. So it's the very construct of things. It's where shape comes from and where shape and form is held, or how it's held together. So all these are very exciting developments, and information is seen to be the top of the pile instead of at the bottom. You see, in the old days, information was something that was contained in matter. Early on, we had books. Oh, well, really early on, we had stone, didn't we? People chiseled lumps out of stone or squidged a piece of stick into soft clay, and it went hard, or the chisel marks on stone. That was pretty solid, solid stuff. But then eventually along came books, which is the same idea. It's still stuff like the black ink on white pages. So matter is containing the information. In our, you know, the last few decades, we're used to the idea that information is contained in electronic form, in a thing like a computer or a cell phone that holds the information. And we've been brought up with that view, but it's suddenly become wrong, and what's happening is that information is holding the cell phone, or information is holding the book, if you like. Not the content of the book, but it's making a book out of a book. So a huge revolution has gone on in physics, and some of them are struggling with it. You know, they still want the matter universe. They want it all to be like the fairy story as it was when they grew up as kids. You've got people like Richard Dawkins stamping his foot and squawking that it's all wrong, it's all an illusion, it's all terribly wicked. The world is real, look, kick it, touch it, it's real, it's real. And it's pretty obvious, actually, that it's not real. It only appears real, I think that's the truth of it. So, at least as big a revolution as the one that Nicholas Copernicus unleashed all those centuries ago. And one of its outstanding proponents and communicators of it is William Tiller. Well, I should say investigators rather than communicator. You know, Bill, his strength is not communicating it, it's investigating it in the first place. Some tell the story and explain it good, and others carry forward the barriers with ingenious tests and experiments. And that's what Bill was good at. And he's become famous, as it were, for one particular set of experiments. I mean, a lot of things since then. But it started from a famous set of experiments in which he and some psychically gifted people were able to place a thought intention into an electronic device and send this electronic device thousands of miles away, and the electronic device still held the thought intention that came from the people. It sounds almost too weird, except that we are kind of getting used to this thing now. But if somebody had done this 50 years ago, it would have been scoffed at as a fraud. There'd be people just say, well, you know, the old scientific principle, it can't be true, therefore it isn't. But Bill is a very vigorous scientist. You heard he's a professor, or was a professor at Stanford University. He had a permanent tenure with his chair. He was a materials scientist. That's how I came to be quoting him in my first book. He'd studied skin and found, you know, different materials characteristics in skin at acupuncture points. He was everything a scientist should be, a careful observer, someone who documented things, measured things, collected figures, was able to analyze them statistically, and come out with this statistical language that you've probably heard him say the word robust a few times. We know that robust means it can't be shaken apart like a car or a garden shed would be robust. It would stand up to a lot of knocking around. Well, in science, robust means kind of the same thing, but in terms of figures, it means you can't really argue with it. You know, the figures are very clear, and it's way beyond chance. The figures are showing very strongly that something is happening. And another term that Bill tossed around a few times there was the P number, P0.0001. Well, that's telling you simply what are the chances of it happening by accident. 0.0001 is one in four noughts. In fact, it's one in 10,000 chance. So if something, the more noughts, the better, meaning it's very, very unlikely that it's ever going to happen by chance. If it's 0.05, that means it's a 50-50. So finding an effect wouldn't mean anything because, there's a 50-50 and it would happen anyway. So maybe you got lucky and you got the effect. If you did it again, it might not get the effect. So we don't like 50-50s. 0.5 is no good, but 0.0001 is very good. It means it's true insofar as science is capable of saying something is true. All science is really saying is that it's probably true. Okay, so he repeated these experiments over and over. They had a small, I don't know the design of the electronic device, but it was specially designed for holding a person's thought intention. And four people would sit round with some particular intention. I can't remember from all the experiments, but the one I do remember is the one that Bill told us about yesterday, in fact, that they said the pH of water, that's the acidity or alkalinity of the water, would shift by one. So if they had the thought, the intention, that this device would lower the pH of water by one, that would mean more hydrogen ions, in other words, more acid. And as I pointed out, a change of one is actually a tenfold increase in hydrogen ions. So, one to two doesn't sound very much, but it's really, it's really like 1 million to 10 million. It's a 9 million jump. It really is it's a whole order of magnitude, as we call it. So what they did was carefully wrap these devices that held intention, and of course they had a control that hadn't been influenced, wrapped in foil to protect them from all electromagnetic effects, sent them away to a laboratory thousands of miles away. And when they placed this device next to some water with a pH measuring device, boom, the pH of the water changed exactly as their intention said it should. So that's pretty good evidence for consciousness being able to influence physical reality, the law of attraction type stuff. Mind over matter. I mean, that phrase has been around long enough that there's nothing new in the idea. But what is new is the science. Again, we're back to Copernicus, like real science showing that this can take place. It's not just a belief, or it isn't. You can't just pass it off as a coincidence, which is what the critics do. They say, if you keep doing it, it'll all even out. No, it's a real effect. That's interesting enough in itself. In fact, it's very, very fascinating. It means there's something way beyond just the physical universe that is capable of influencing the physical universe. I do apologize. I need to take a drink of water. But it only got more interesting from there. Now, you may have picked up on this that Bill was saying, which is that when you keep doing the experiments, it gets easier and it works better. And so Bill began to develop this concept that he called conditioned space. What had happened in that space seemed to imprint a memory on the space. Now, this is, again, it's not quite a new idea. This is new science, okay? I'll come back to it in a minute. But it's not quite a new idea. If if loving, friendly, gentle, wise people have lived in a house or a place for a long time, we're used to the idea that it can develop a feeling, you know, there's something there that warms. And you find this often in ancient temples or religious, spiritual, ritual grounds, that you can sometimes feel something there. A very dear friend of mine years ago, about 15 years ago, we went on a tour of stone circles in the southwest of England, and there are hundreds. I mean, there are not just Stonehenge, okay, that's the big one. There are hundreds that are maybe 20 to 50 feet round or 100 feet round, seeing which ones still had the energies, and it's amazing. I mean, it sounds a bit woo-woo, but, you know, I can feel energies, and she certainly can. We wanted to see which ones were alive. Most of them were dead, but some of them still held the energy that went back to Neolithic times. So it's not a strange idea, but anyway, here's the scientific proof that these things got easier. There was a more pronounced effect when you kept doing these intention experiments in the same room. So it was as if the room kind of remembered what's going on here and made it easier for you. And that tied in beautifully, as I pointed out, with what Rupert Sheldrake was telling us. He talked about morphic resonance and quoted examples like rats in a maze. You can put rats through a maze and time them, and you know how long on average it will take. But then you find that all subsequent rats get quicker. It's as if there's some memory there that helps out the rats. So they've got a much faster learning of how to get through the maze. And of course, you do all the usual things like using control rats and make sure the second lot of rats are not related or connected or haven't been anywhere near the ones that already did it. So, you know, there was no crossover of information, even at sort of rat brain level. It was simply something held in the air. And this is what Rupert Sheldrake called the morphic field. The morphic resonance effect was a sort of learning effect. And it shows up time and time again. And in fact, it's shown up in history. And this is another really fascinating thing that people write about. When discoveries and breakthroughs, scientific breakthroughs are made, there's often, you know, nothing happens for centuries. Then all of a sudden, two or three people in a row all come up with the same thing within a few years of each other. The best example known is with calculus. Calculus is an advanced system of math that was a brilliant breakthrough. And Sir Isaac Newton appears to be the first person to actually do it, but he didn't publish straight away. He waited 20 years before he published it. But within a few years of him coming up with calculus in England, Leibniz came up with calculus in Germany. And he published first. So of course, the Germans crow about that and insist he has priority. But in fact, you know, historical records are very clear that Newton thought of it first. He figured out how it works first. But as I say, he didn't publish. So it led to a lot of acrimony and argument, actually. And Newton wasn't very nice about it. He accused Leibniz of stealing his data. And it's happened in other situations. Girolamo Cardano came up with the square root of minus one. He got this at about the same time. I've forgotten the name of the other man. I think it was Tartino, or Taraltini, one of those Italian names anyway. Mathematicians will know who I'm talking about. And again, there was a furious row broke out that one had stolen it from the other. But actually, when you look at investigate these things and lay them out in history, it's pretty clear that it keeps occurring over and over, that when somebody thinks of something, somebody else, somewhere else, comes up with almost the same idea. You know, a bit of the 100 monkeys thing, except that there's maybe only one or two monkeys in the game. But this is a learning effect. So I don't see it as very different. Like, if the morphic field is true, the morphic resonance is true, these historical examples are true, then there's no surprise, really, and it's not too strange to accept the idea that space, remembering there isn't any space, no such thing now, is there? It's all non-local. Everything's connected to everything else. But because of this morphic field idea and the learning field, then that explains how these things happen. Okay, so very exciting stuff from Bill. You know, it was first really serious and incontrovertible experiments, And it pretty well, you know, cost him his job. He didn't get fired. But, you know, that scientists have a nasty habit of making people so uncomfortable they can't go on working in an environment. Scientists are not, you know, clever, objective, cool investigators of the sort they like to pretend. They're childish, stupid, emotional, aggressive. They get very protective and territorial, almost like a hormonal thing, really. It's all very stupid, and they call it science. Well, of course, we use this other word you may have come across called scientism, where it's the pretense of science and, you know, handing out words and pretending that what you've done is scientific when it's just opinions, and then pretending what other people have done, even if it's good science, isn't science, it's just rubbish, but that's only your opinion that it's rubbish. There's a lot, there's far too much of that around these days, scientism. Okay, so what's the model here? I wanted to go on, and Bill did come up with this. I tried to draw him on this, but he's very difficult with it because he immediately starts delving off into 10 dimensions, 11 dimensions, then there's a 12th dimension. I wanted him to keep it, and Riemann geometry, right, that's another one. I wanted to keep it simple, so I really tried to focus him on just the two key parts of his model, and it's really just down to words. There is the ordinary physical. We're typically used to calling it four-dimensional space, this idea from Einstein that time is a dimension. I regret that because it rather rules out the fact that there may be other physical dimensions and time isn't really a dimension because, typically you can travel either direction in a dimension, whereas time doesn't seem quite that easy to travel backwards in time. So it doesn't really fit the definition of a dimension in my view. But anyway, it's usually included as part of the four-dimensional material world, you know, matter, energy, space, and time. And he called that D space, D for dimension, I guess, D space. And then there was what he called a reciprocal space. Now, this is not, you heard me questioning him, this is not quite the same as the information field or the morphic field or the energy field or the quantum probability field. Those are sort of reflected in what comes out in the physical. What Bill was saying, this reciprocal, you have to understand the word reciprocal, which it means the opposite of. So when one's plus, the other one's minus. When one's big, the other one's small, and so on. It means in reverse, not so it's not just a mirror image from one to the other, it's a reciprocated space, an inverse space, if you understand that term. And that's that, to him, that's very important. And this R space, reciprocal space, carries a lot of energies, huge amounts of energies that influence the physical space. So what he was saying here with his model is that, do you remember him saying how much energy is in reciprocal space, what's called the vacuum, you know, the thing that's out there that's supposed to hold everything else, you know, the material, the matter, energy, space, and time lives in this other space. We call it a vacuum, but it's far from empty. In one of my lecture series, I'm fond of quoting Richard Feynman that said, in a few square feet of this thing, there's enough energy to boil all the world's oceans. Wow. And Bill came up with something even more startling. In something about the size of a hydrogen atom, which is pretty small, the vacuum actually contains enough real energy, more real energy than all the stars and galaxies put together. I mean, you can't grasp what these things are. It's just by metaphor. If you actually even tried to grasp it, I think you'd hurt yourself. I think you'd blow your mind apart. It's really almost ungraspable, such a concept, when we see the tiny amount of energy we've got here and the absolutely minute amount of energy that's released when a hydrogen bomb goes off. Look what a big bang that is and how much destruction. To think of that as a billionth, trillionth, quadrillionth of the kind of energies that are out there is, it's beyond scary if you think about it. So I drew Bill on this question, and I think it's an important one, and I want you to remember it, which is that so if we therefore influence things in this other space, that's where all the energy is, then that itself will easily interact with and bend the real space. And he said, yes. And of course, that's a model we used to. But remember this, okay? If you want to be doing telepathy, or if you want to try telekinesis, you know, you want to put a pen down on your desk and make it move 6 inches by just thinking, move 6 inches, you're not likely to be able to do it in this reality. And of course, that's our common experience. Things tend not to follow. But if you can somehow access this second reciprocal space and influence it even a tiny amount, the fact that it's got billions of squillions of times the energy means it will then interact with our space and make the thing happen. And so those very strange stories of telekinesis and levitation and things like that start to make sense. Something has to have happened in the vacuum reciprocal space for that anything significant or identifiable or measurable to happen in this space. Okay, so once you connect the dots there, it becomes very exciting. Now, there are a lot of things that we, well, it was Bill's stage, really, and you know, his experiments are very exciting and interesting to listen to. But there's even more. You know, I want to share with you some more stories from this kind of concept. One of the ones I wanted to bring out, didn't really get chance, but was yesterday, was Peter Garayev's Phantom DNA Effect. Now, Peter Garayev is an orthodox Russian scientist. He found things so strange that his orthodox colleagues couldn't tolerate it and got rid of him, as they do. It's funny, isn't it? Instead of being excited about the advances in knowledge, so-called scientists just freeze up and they don't want to know. They're not interested, which is a shame. Anyway, Peter Garayev did a whole series of interesting experiments, but one of the outstanding ones was to show that DNA has a kind of energetic shadow. Now, before his experimental work, I did actually bring up this idea in my book, Virtual Medicine, that DNA, I mean, the idea of DNA carrying as a chemical messenger carrying on human shape or any shape, you know, chickens and dandelions, is crazy and absurd. That's orthodox science has totally collapsed. Forget genes. There is nothing. You heard Rupert Sheldrake say it. I'm not just being ridiculous. He said the same thing. All that DNA can do is replicate proteins. It has nothing to do with able to tell what the shape of a frog is like or the shape of a human being. It's got no way of influencing whether the person has blue eyes or brown eyes or inherits hemophilia or things like that. So, you know, genes just don't mean anything in those terms. So how does DNA carry the message? Does DNA carry the message? Well, I believe it does, and there's good reasons for thinking that. Well, first of all, it does carry the message, but there's good reason to think that DNA itself is the instrument. It's actually folded and refolded just like at what's called a fractal aerial. Now, fractal aerials, you know, fractals are very modern. Fractal aerials are very modern. They're what we use in our cell phones. They're extremely efficient. We've, you know, gone way past the old days, like a walkie-talkie radio where you had to have this aerial waving around to pick up the signal. This super folded aerial is folded up in the back of your cell phone and is actually more efficient. And because DNA has that sort of shape, it's very good at receiving, but also for the same reasons, very good at transmitting. So it's very likely that DNA is transmitting a morphic field signal that, you know, I mean, DNA is about the only thing that passes from parents to the child, well, physically anyway. It may be that we just inherit morphic fields. But in terms of stuff, DNA, you know, it all breaks down to chromosomes, DNA that divide, and then they all start dividing again and making cells from there. So the common link between generations, between parent and child generation, really, the common link is DNA. So it's carrying something. Well, what Peter Garayev showed is that DNA is able to carry a shape field, a morphic field of this kind. He showed, let me tell you, first of all, he showed that DNA absorbs light, absorbs photons. That's very interesting because from the work of Fritz Popp, we know that biophotons characterize life. And in fact, when living things stop associating with photons, that means they're dead. That's the final thing that happens when a an organism or a cell dies, it just gives up its photons, and there's this flash of light that's called the death flash. So we're on good ground here. So here's DNA that seems to be like a photon sponge. It absorbs photons, and these follow the shape of the DNA, and you can see the structure of the DNA. What was interesting in Gurayev's work is that when you take away the DNA, it's still there. Yes, I'm not contradicting myself. The spiral of photons that were bound in this form stay where they were, just as if the DNA was around. So the DNA makes them adopt this shape, but it's not the DNA itself. It's somehow a message or an information field from the DNA. And it was really extraordinary. He not only took away the DNA, but Gurayev would use frozen nitrogen to smash up this DNA image, this DNA ghost that was remaining, and it would disappear for maybe 10 minutes, but then he would come back, and he'd hit it again with liquid nitrogen. And again, it would break up, but just for a few minutes and reform. This is absolutely extraordinary. It means there's this kind of information field. It's almost, you know, indestructible. It isn't really. It lasted about 30 days. This ghost or phantom DNA lingered for about 30 days. Quite amazing. But now, that's not unique. Let me tell you, I didn't even get a chance to bring up that story. But of course, that fits very nicely with the idea of the information field and what Bill was calling, he used that term conjugate space. That simply means the mixture of the information background space with the ordinary four-dimensional physical space that we are used to and that we inhabit. There are other DNA experiments being done that are very interesting. And this is using lasers, and this is will be interesting because I'm going to come back to lasers when I talk about coherence. Laser light, listen, let's not get into the technicalities of it. Suffice it to say, it's extremely coherent. It's artificial. It wasn't around until we figured out how to make lasers. There was no natural coherent light. It's all incoherent or chaotic, if you like. Life seems to have the only capability for generating coherent things, including coherent light, as Fritz Popper shown. So coherence is an important property of life anyway, but it also holds information. Now, bear that in mind. You can't carry much information in chaos. If you imagine a telephone that's generating hundreds of thousands or millions of signals at once, it's going to be impossible to pick out a voice or make it say anything like a voice. And that's really what happens. There's no information. When it's coherent, it can carry information. So let's move from Peter Gurayev for a moment to another Russian. The Russians are very good at this. A man called Vlail Kaznacheyev. I'm not going to spell that for you. I'll try and post it with with the link if you want to go and Google him, Vlail Kaznacheyev. And he showed also that you could carry DNA information in ultraviolet light. What he did was take some cells that were infected with viruses, so diseased cells, in a dish, and put those near another dish that contained completely healthy cells, and shone ultraviolet light through the diseased cells into the healthy cells. Now, what do you think happened? Well, what actually happened was that viruses appeared in the healthy cells. They weren't transferred there. They were taken there as information from the virus DNA. Oh yeah, I forgot to say that. Remember that viruses are basically DNA. There's not much else to them. They're just a little packet of DNA. One of the medical jokes is that viruses are a piece of bad news wrapped in protein. You should remember that. anyway, so in Kaznacheyev's experiment, he was showing that you can carry information of disease. Now, of course, my ears pricked up with this kind of thing as a doctor, as an MD, and this is absolutely the kind of thing I was writing about in my book, Virtual Medicine, is that disease begins primarily as an information field. Disease is in the information. What follows is it then sets up the energy of the disease and the energy impacts the physical and changes the physical nature of the state of the organism. So you start with an information field that says cancer. You then get cancer energy. This may be weeks, months, or even years later. You get cancer energy, and eventually the cancer energy creates a physical cancer. So sooner or later, the lump will manifest itself. That's been a model that I've known and understood for a long time, and as I said, wrote about that back in the 90s. But here's Kazimierz doing exactly the same thing, showing that you can transfer disease by passing information from one group of organisms to another group of an organism, or it can be from one bunch of cells to another bunch of cells. Absolutely fascinating. Listen, even we're not even close yet. Even more fascinating. Well, even more dramatic, I should say. It's not more fascinating, but it's extremely dramatic. It's like, whoa. It was an experiment series done by a Chinaman called Zhang Kangeng, K-A-N-G-E-N-G. You could go Google him. And what he did was the same kind of thing. He was passing light from a donor to an acceptor. And what the donor in this case was ducklings, chicks, duck chicks. And the recipient or the acceptor was, well, what he called a pregnant mother. It means a hen with, egg-laying capabilities that is in the reproductive phase of her life. What he did was shine light through ducks into chick eggs. And guess what happened? Well, no, it wasn't ducks that hatched, but what hatched was very contained bits of duck. The creatures that came out were kind of hybrids between chickens and ducklings. Some of them had flat beaks and they had rather longer necks than you see with a chick. They'd got webbing between their toes like a duck has, and the larger, like a duck with its internal organs. He did that same thing with a bigger population. He took 500 eggs. Of those 500 eggs, 480 chicks hatched. And 80% of those had flat bills. These are chicken eggs, right? But 80% had flat bills like a duck. 90% had eyes moved to a position rather like that of the duck towards the front. And 25% of them had webbing between the toes. So they were sort of part chicken and part duck. What was interesting was that they remained that way. I mean, it's one of those, it's almost like a science fiction story, a new Frankenstein experiment. I mean, talk about Franken foods and GMO foods. Listen, people getting agitated about genetically modified foods haven't really understood even the beginnings of the game yet. It's scary what can be done. But it's also exciting and thrilling what can be done. What it shows is that we are truly living in an information universe. We are learning that light, and especially coherent light, can carry signals. Kangeng used polarized light, and Kazimierz used ultraviolet light. That was interesting, by the way, because and you can prove it was being carried by the light, because Kazimierz put a screen of glass between the two dishes. And nothing was transferred. Glass, we know, blocks ultraviolet light. But if he took away the glass and instead substituted quartz, we know that quartz will pass through ultraviolet light. Just, it's transparent to ultraviolet light. Lets it through. So the fact that it was blocked by glass but not blocked by quartz tells us that the ultraviolet light element is what is carrying that signal. It's what's transferring the virus. Well, I can say moieties now, can't I, having defined the word early on. So virus moieties appear in the second dish. Well, it's all very exciting and, of course, enormous potential for healing. Garayev took a look at this. Peter Garayev, who I just mentioned, the phantom DNA man, he did an interesting experiment taking seeds that had been killed by radiation from Chernobyl. And he shone coherent light, laser light, through the seeds, through healthy seeds, let me get this right, shone light through healthy living seeds into the dead seeds. And hey presto, the dead seeds came back to life. Now, we haven't done that with humans yet. You might wonder, and I do, just how far away we are from that. You know, we may be very close. It may be next year, maybe 20 years. But it certainly happened with seeds. And again, you know, I emphasize that Gureyev is a serious scientist like Bill. You know, he works at universities and he knows what he's doing. He did an even more interesting experiment using rats. And what he did was poison rats and then bring them back to life using light shone from healthy rats. Whoa. Yes, you heard that right. Actually, a little bit more complicated than that. Let me just explain. He took a population of rats and used a toxin called alloxan, alloxan, which destroys the pancreas. So what he did was use alloxan to destroy the pancreas. The rats would develop raging diabetes and then die. However, if he gave them alloxan and then followed that up by shining light through a healthy pancreas into the poisoned rats, they continued with healthy pancreas. Their pancreas didn't get damaged. They didn't die. It was really quite an amazing experiment, if you think about it. So, of course, I was interested there, thinking, well, can we, you know, get rid of lung cancer by shining light through healthy lungs into a person with lung cancer? And the answer, ladies and gentlemen, is I'm 99.999% sure the answer is yes, we're nearly there. This was the whole premise of my book, Virtual Medicine, that in the virtual or the second or informational domain is contained the whole secrets of health and disease. And fooling around with the physical stuff like doctors do is missing the point. In fact, right at the beginning of Virtual Medicine, I quoted Carlo Rubbia. He was the Nobel laureate for physics in 1984. Or was it 86? No, I think it was 86. His quote is clear enough. He said only 1/1,000,000th, that's with a B, only 1/1,000,000,000th of the universe is stuff, is matter. Everything else is information and energy. So what he's saying is, in medical terms, doctors that are fooling around with the stuff are only dealing with 1/1,000,000,000th of the problem. No wonder they're pretty useless. And they're busy hacking and, surgery and also poisoning. I mean, I say this very often, by the way. Some of you may not have heard me say it, but I say it often enough, that almost all medical drugs act by poisoning. That's what they do. They poison off some part of the system, so it stops functioning and the symptom goes away. Haha. Well, if you pulled the plug on the telephone, you wouldn't get any more complaints. But that's not quite the same as getting rid of complaints, is it? I'm sure you'll agree. And it's pretty well like that with drugs. So, and it's all the wrong kind of medicine. You know, we're dealing with the physical when the real trouble lies in the energetic and informational. It's just totally missing the point, as I said. So we can take treatment modalities like homeopathy. Now, I haven't got time here to explain homeopathy. It's a big subject. But let me suffice it to say that homeopathy is an informational exchange system. It's not even energy. You know, it's so diluted, there's no nothing left. It's just water. But the water, and of course that's what the critics jump on, there's nothing there, so it's all a hoax. Well, there is something there. There's not stuff there, but there's information there. So with homeopathy, you can adjust the information in this subspace, the underlying or background informational space, and that will tweak the physical space. Change the information, you change the energy, then you change the physical stuff. So that's important. Okay, well, listen, fabulous stuff to talk about like that. Bill led us on into such fascinating territories. But let me pick up a couple more. Oh, sorry, there's one more Gureyev experiment I should have shared with you, because this is also about as weird as it comes, and it's so exciting. I must add it at this point. Gureyev was trying to use what I've just described to you. He was trying to shine laser light from a very healthy person into a diseased person. And in this case, it was a woman, an old woman. He wanted to rejuvenate her somewhat. And he had the idea of shining these beams through a child, a healthy, vigorous child. This put me in mind immediately of one of the homeopathic remedies that we use, made by the German company Heel, H-E-E-L, which is made from human placenta. You know, it's practically fetal cells and fetal tissue. Very exciting, very energizing tissues. Anyway, I would have used placenta, but he didn't. He picked just a young, healthy boy, shone the light through the healthy boy, with the intention of producing changes in the woman. And he did. But the thing he was totally surprised by was that she started to grow teeth. Okay, now if you know any physiology and biology, you'll know we get one set of teeth called milk teeth. They drop out, and then you get another set called permanent teeth. And that's it. There isn't a third set. So this woman had lost almost all her teeth. She was wearing dental plates. But as a side effect, if you like, of this experiment, she began to grow teeth. Lumps appeared in her gums and burst through. These were wisdom teeth at the back. Anyway, the dentist had to adjust her plate and everything. And it reminded me of a story that I always thought was an apocryphal story. I've never been able to source it, and if anyone can source this story truly, I don't mean, you know, somebody said it happened or somebody else knew somebody who knew somebody else who said it happened. I mean the person to whom it happened reporting. I'd love to follow this story, but you've all heard it. It was back in the 80s of a child in South America lost a limb or a hand, and then promptly started to regrow it, and the new limb was appearing, whereupon doctors said, this is absurd, you can't do this, so the limb stopped growing. The challenge with, I mean, obviously, the you know, doctors couldn't tolerate the idea of healing at that level, they would scare them to death, so they stopped it effectively. But if they hadn't, it would have been interesting to see what degree of recovery took place. But you might feel the weakness of the story is that's kind of an absurd idea. We're not salamanders, you know, growing new arms and legs. But now with what I've just told you, you'll realize it's perfectly possible. And maybe the time will come instead of, you know, when a person has an amputation, we can, you know, shine light through a health, say somebody, take off somebody's leg, shine light through a healthy leg, and the person will start to regrow it. We know a person has the shape of a leg there. The person gets phantom sensations from the nerves, but there's also an energetic field there. That's curly and photography territory. Anyway, I'm going to leave that now. We talked about entropy, and I think it's very important to bring that up a little bit. This is important science for us in the field of consciousness. Bill was kind enough to remind me of work by Claude Shannon, who is a very Irish-sounding name, but he was an American, actually, and he worked for Bell Telephone. And he was a communications engineer, effectively. And they were studying things like the number of bits that you require, you know, the amount of information in proportion to how you encoded it. It's a very well-established theory. If you go to Google and type in Claude Shannon, they will bring you up this Claude Shannon. Shannon, like the Irish River, you know, S-H-A-N-N-O-N. It will bring up that Claude Shannon, for sure. Long story short, where he ended up was saying that information seems to be the reverse of entropy. Now, let's start pulling some... I'll explain to you what entropy is again, and then we'll start pulling some threads together. Entropy is the winding down of the universe. This is what all physicists believe happens. It's unavoidable. It comes from the second law of thermodynamics, and eventually all the heat and energy of the universe will run down and disappear, and it'll be cold and dead and nothing moving because of movement, you know, movement of molecules all comes from heat. It's a very gloomy, it's called heat death, and it was a very gloomy Victorian view of the universe, and it demotivated, actually. A lot of scientists and philosophers and poets, they all thought, well, what's the point, you know, we're not going anywhere. It's a very sad movement, in a way, this heat death movement. Anyway, that's what's supposed to happen, okay? It's the sort of winding down model. I mean, lots of time, okay? It would take thousands of billions of trillions of squillions of years to get there. We don't know how long, but eventually it'll all run down and it'll all collapse to nothing, just an empty, meaningless void that was once a universe. But that's not true. And there are several famous scientists who have got onto this track. One of them was Erwin Schrödinger. Now, he was one of the founders of modern quantum physics. You may have heard of Schrödinger's cat. I mentioned it in one of these workshops, I think. Can't remember which. But most of these early boys, you know, we heard about Paul Dirac and negative energy yesterday from Bill, and there was de Broglie and Schrödinger, the uncertainty principle man. Anyway, it begins with W. I need a coffee. It'll come to me in a minute. But anyway, all these people, they all became very philosophical. You know, they realized that they were treading on the toes of God. They were creating a whole new universe that didn't make much sense in the old mechanical terms. There was definitely something amazing, something or other going on in this universe. And they all were philosophers, including Schrödinger. But he had a saying that life eats negative entropy. Negative entropy is a made-up idea. There isn't supposed to be such a thing. But negative entropy would mean going the other way. So instead of running down, it's building up. That itself, by the way, is quite an amazing concept and does seem to relate to life. You know, if you accept anything like an evolutionary idea, then you've got to understand you're flying in the face of physics and science. What this entropy law says is that things are getting more chaotic. They're not becoming orderly, they're becoming disorderly, whereas evolution says things are becoming more orderly. There's a line in Lyle Watson's famous book, Supernature, where he says that really anything as unlikely as a molecule, I mean, a molecule is very, very unlikely in terms of probability. Things shouldn't be able to organize in themselves into anything, even as complex as a molecule. And life becomes wildly improbable. And I remember those words from Lyle Watson's book. And yet life does seem to be going that way, doesn't it? Somehow things are getting more organized. Mankind has advanced. Mankind has come out at the top of the pile as this amazing, organized, evolved, and advanced thing. Yes, I know there are lots of very not advanced things about human beings, especially males, women would say. But, you know, you get the principle that to have grown such a complex organism as us has completely flown in the face of entropy. So maybe Schrödinger's right. Entropy, the life is eating negative entropy. So life is swallowing lots of negative entropy. It's going against entropy. Therefore, life is able to get organized and evolved. So what Shannon was saying here is that information also seems to beat entropy. The more information in a system, the less entropy. Even more interesting, if you add information to a system, you reduce the entropy. So again, it seems that life and consciousness is all involved in this. You remember me saying information implies consciousness. I mean, the whole idea of information has no meaning unless you've got somebody to read it and think about it and interpret. You know, you need consciousness there for the very concept of information to mean anything at all. So it's another way of saying, and another scientific route by which you come back to the fact that consciousness rules, that consciousness lives in this universe via these information fields that regulate what's happening in the physical. And it ought to be, it isn't, but it ought to be very easy for consciousness to change reality. You know, the law of attraction run mad. You know, you say, well, I want that, and it will appear on your desk within seconds. We've not reached that stage. But in fact, from what we now understand to be the construction of the universe, we should be in that. You know, we should be able to achieve that. And what Bill was saying very passionately, he believes if you read his book, like Psychoenergetic Science is the book I recommended, or got him to recommend for himself, that this is what it's saying, that, you know, as we evolve, as we learn more, we are tending towards this more advanced state where we can do much more with consciousness to control our reality than is supposed to have been possible to happen in the past. You know, that it's not just what exceptional individuals can do, but it's what everyone should do. And he went through some mythical models. You know, he talked about Atlantis and Lemuria and the society known as Mu, M-U. people remember these or talk about these as if they're realities. You're into past lives then, and we are going to be doing those later in this series to see what that teaches us about consciousness and being. But anyway, you know, he felt these old society traditions of magical, empowered societies of fabulous beings with amazing abilities was not unreal, that in fact that probably was true from history. There really were such things. And he moved out from that one, as he does in his book, to talk about, and in fact he also, this will come up when we talk to Hazel Courtney, my friend Hazel, when she comes to talk with us later as well, this trend towards coherence. Hazel has written a book, in fact, on the fact that we're all heading towards coherence, at which point the sort of physical or mechanical factors of existence and reality will disappear. It'll become consciousness as inhered in the form of information and coherence and or these, well, almost, you might say godlike states and abilities. Bill's model was that we were very coherent in the beginning, the divine, as it were, and that we gradually fell apart. We decohered, so we got poorer and poorer at that. And as we did so, pardon me, and as we did so, we kind of decayed from certain dimensions into lower dimensions and coarser dimensions, until we have ended up where we are in the sort of the blobby, rather coarse physical thing, which hasn't got much spirit in it. Well, indeed, it hasn't, as you know. It's rather the opposite of spirit. Spirit is a light and insubstantial, non-material thing, and the physical universe is very much the opposite. So it's rather as if we're going down through a cycle. We're cycling down and down from less and less spirituality into more and more of the physical. And the spirit, of course, struggles against this, but has been unable to block this deterioration, if you like. But Bill feels that it's only a cycle. You know, we go downwards, and then we start to go backwards. We head towards home and towards source. Listen, these cycles can take millions or billions of years. Time doesn't really enter into it, because we're not talking time. We're talking about outside the physical universe. But what happens is that we gradually move backwards towards this cohered and rather divine state. Our coherence will return. And you remember me asking him, is this a natural cycle? Will it happen like, you know, the sun, Earth going around the sun? Is it just a cycling season, or can we influence this? And he felt very strongly that we can influence it, that if we choose to go in that pathway, that we can make it happen, that we can take ourselves towards coherence. Coherence seems to be the state associated with love and harmony, the opposite of chaos and entropy. A lot of people have been on near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences, especially NDEs, you know, the ones who have been to the light and they've gone home and they've seen, they all talk about this immensely overpoweringly beautiful, just literally overpowering, it can't be born, intensity, feeling of love when they get there. It's coherence beyond anything that we can imagine, and love and coherence really do go hand in hand. It's the very opposite of incoherence and the chaos that we see in the physical universe. It's also very still. Someday I'm going to release one of my writings called Tractatus Secundus. It's the second Tractatus. The first one was a rather wordy thing by Ludwig Wittgenstein. I'm not comparing myself to him. But, you know, it's just logical deduction of from that follows that and from that follows that. If you start with the fact that consciousness came first, in other words, consciousness is not just a bunch of molecules that woke up one day and said, hey, we're here, which is what modern biology and physics is trying to sell to you. Ridiculous idea that a bunch of atoms suddenly said, hey, I'm awake. Do you know I can see things? Can you see me? It's as stupid as it sounds. A much more sensible idea, and one that works on all the models, is that consciousness was there first. and that constructed views, you know, dimension points, which constructs space, started to make changes in this space, which would create time and so on. Much more sensible. I mean, it really fits. But it's this. If consciousness came first, there was no matter, energy, space, and time. Therefore, there was no motion. I'm not going to get more technical than that just now, but let's just suffice it to say, no motion. If you've got time, you need motion. Matter or physical stuff, atom, they're all moving. Energies about motion, and so on. So consciousness there first would be a state of no motion. And isn't that what people say? You know, poets and mystics and spiritually aware people, people have been into this space, even if they've just touched the periphery, all say the same thing. It's incredibly still and peaceful and loving and beautiful. It's the very opposite of our frantic universe that is moving so fast. The wavelengths, the movements and energies, look, first of all, the Big Bang idea, we all started off as an explosion, you know, a big splat, and we're still part of the explosion, it's going on forever. All of that's horrible motion, if you think about it. So it's the very opposite of spirit. And when you start to pull the threads together like this, you get a model, you know, that makes sense, a model of consciousness that is not the physical. It doesn't belong in matter, energy, space, and time. Therefore, it has none of the characteristics of matter, energy, space, and time. Therefore, it is coherent. And that coherence we feel as love, you know, a gentle connectedness. Look, what I was telling you, what happened when you shine coherent light through things, it can carry a living message of life. It all starts to make sense, and it all becomes a wonderful model. And this is the model I've been trying to share with you, ladies and gentlemen, you, my very good friends and expert people that I've got to join me and be explaining all this for you. You can see how now it's building up into a wonderful picture, and it's a very exciting picture. It's a whole new science. Indeed, it is a second Copernican scale revolution. I can't put it any better than that. Consciousness and information rules the universe. Okay, well, I hope you found that a useful extension to what Bill was telling us, and I hope you can integrate this model with your life and also with the other talks that you'll hear. It all fits. It all makes sense. It's not just logical. It's beautiful. It's a model that contains love, peace, beauty, and spirit. What more could you want? Thank you very much for listening.